ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman?
Yes?
Did you ever think about surgical training, becoming a surgeon?
I did actually think about becoming a surgeon, yeah. The training in Britain, which is where I trained originally, is very different from Australia. So when you graduated, you didn't go on this big rotation around different parts of the hospital every 3 months. You did 6 months medicine and 6 months surgery. And my 6 months surgery was in London with a great boss. I loved it. And I actually got to do, probably not very safely, a lot of surgery. And I really seriously considered it. I really liked it.
I never really contemplated surgical. I loved my burns when we learnt about burns in med school. Mm-hmm. I contemplated it. And my husband
had to become a plastic surgery.
Yeah,
that, didn't
you do. And then I was like, that is just not me. And I actually don't like doing interventional things. I'm much more, let's talk to people and fix the medical things. So I didn't really contemplate it. And it is quite a difficult life when you're training, and actually getting onto the training can be quite the journey.
Yep. You've got to know anatomy. It's not easy. You've got to do long
hours. And you've got to get a spot. You've got to get a spot on training.
Yeah, that's just a minor little detail. But getting a spot on training schemes is what we're going to talk about today, because there are a lot of doctors around Australia in limbo, not getting onto training schemes and doing the work of junior surgeons.
That is coming up on today's Health Report. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal land.
Also coming up on the show, the number of gout flares that you have if you do have gout can actually give an insight into your risk of heart disease.
And there are more people with gout than you might realise.
Correct.
So what's the news this week?
We're starting with some good news. This week marks 20 years since the human papillomavirus, or HPV vaccine, people might know it as Gardasil, since it was produced in Australia.
We went on the market, that's right. And, of course, based on Australian research.
Yes, Ian Fraser.
University of Queensland. So this has been an amazing journey. And it's got even better through the years. I mean, it started off as just covering four versions of the virus. Now it's nine versions. And, of course, now boys get immunised as well as girls. And the rates of cervical cancer are coming down.
Yes, and Australia's on track to eliminate cervical cancer by 2035, which is wonderful news.
And there are few, if any, cases in women under 25, even though it was always very rare in that group beforehand. And people think of this as a cervical cancer vaccine, but it's more than that.
It is. So human papillomavirus can cause other cancers, so it can actually be a contributing factor in some oral cancers, in anal cancers as well.
And some people believe it's esophageal cancer too.
It is actually amazing that we might eliminate cervical cancer, Norman. Like, as a GP, this is a big part of what I do, and that's partly due to the vaccination program, but also due to the cervical cancer screening program, which you still need to have done every 5 years if you have a cervix. You can now do self-collection, but even if you're vaccinated, you should still have the screening test done.
Yep. It's a very important complement to this process, which is now every 5 years. And involves looking for the virus, and then there's a whole protocol around that. But it's certainly less invasive than it used to be.
The unfortunate thing is that I actually saw a comment from Associate Professor Marilyn Clark, who is an obstetrician gynaecologist, this week, talking about that under the current vaccination and screening rates in Australia, First Nations women were actually projected to be 21 years behind other Australian women in terms of cervical cancer elimination. So the First Nations women population, when it comes to cervical cancer, is still much more vulnerable. The rates are higher. And so, yeah, it's just sad that it's not unanimously everybody in Australia is on track for 2035.
That gap just gets everywhere, and we should be ashamed of it.
There's a new Senate committee which has been formed, which is going to highlight women's experiences, particularly in the postpartum phase. Now, this is... I think it's amazing it has taken us this long to get here. But this committee is going to look at several things. They're going to look at postpartum healthcare. They're going to look at people's experiences of medical misogyny, women's psychological experiences in the postpartum phase, the amount of reproductive support they get. This is all after a South Australian Labor Senator, Marielle Smith, who shared her experiences with postpartum anxiety and called for this committee to be formed. This is a very vulnerable time, Norman,
in
people's lives. And it can be the Wild West. There's no actual standardised breastfeeding guidelines or there's a lot of grey here and very vulnerable individuals.
And much misunderstood and there's a lot of confusion, even something like postpartum depression.
Yes. So on the back of this, the RACGP, so the Royal Australian College of GPs, is also calling for a dedicated, funded GP-led postpartum care plan, with the establishment of a National Breastfeeding Advisory Council, which is so long overdue. It can be really difficult for women to access support. And they're calling for the states and territories to actually make the pregnancy baby book, handbook, green book, blue book, depending on which state you live in, digital, which I can't tell you how excited I would be for that.
I can see in your face.
Yes.
You're just riveted by it.
But this committee is so needed, Norman. I just can't tell you how vulnerable and uncertain and grey it is, and what care you get between different rooms depending on where you live. It's often not standardised. There's not guidelines. There's not consensus. And so, gosh, we have such a huge space where we need to do better.
And we'll keep an eye on that committee and its progress as it goes on. And I thought I'd just mention some really interesting and good Australian research into schizophrenia and other major mental health problems such as bipolar disorder and major depression. They've looked at the genes that are activated in various parts of the brain and in people who've actually died. So this is using a brain bank, and it was done in association with a German group. And what they were looking at were actually the chemical tags that sit around the genes, that sit around your chromosomes, that actually control your genes. They turn them on, they turn them off, they turn them up, they turn them down. And it's called the epigenome, or it's called the study is called epigenetics. And they were looking at the epigenetics around stress-related genes in particular parts of the brain. And in summary, they found that these chemical tags that control the stress genes in schizophrenia have been stripped away, which means the stress genes are turned on. And the sample wasn't large enough, but they actually believe it applies to major depression and bipolar disorder as well. And the significance here is that they've known for years that people with schizophrenia and other major psychiatric problems are very stress sensitive, and stress can actually bring on the symptoms. And this gives a clue as to why this might occur, and therefore perhaps designing better drugs to deal with this particular problem.
Do we have any idea as to why these chemical tags get stripped away?
What influences epigenetics is the environment. So the environment has a very powerful influence on these chemical tags. And it's likely and certainly possible that early life stress and childhood disadvantage could actually have an influence on this epigenome and strip away the effects, because it's known, again, that early life stress, childhood disadvantage, deprivation in children can affect their stress responses later on in life. And this could give the genetic reason for it.
In our weekly now WTF segment, and we missed you the last 2 weeks, Norman.
Yeah.
I was going to use the nickname I have for you that I know you don't want me to say on air.
No, you can say it on air.
Oh, I call him Spawn Dog.
WTF?
Yeah, correct. But no, Spawn Dog, there have been 2 deaths from measles in the United States, in Pennsylvania. They're in unvaccinated individuals. We are not sure as to whether these are adults or children. Those details have not yet been released.
There's one newspaper or one outlet in the United States reporting that one was in an infant, but we don't have that confirmation.
This is in the context of a measles outbreak in the United States. And
nearly 3,000 cases this year.
Yes, and Maryland has declared it is in an outbreak situation. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Trump are, in the last week again, making some very non-evidence-based claims linking vaccines to autism. I watched it on my Instagram feed and just shuddered, Norman.
Yeah. And interestingly, this in Pennsylvania, these 2 deaths were in Lancaster County. And the relevance of that is that's where there's a large Amish community. And the Amish community traditionally have low vaccination rates, which means they haven't caused the problem here. But when there's an outbreak, they are particularly vulnerable. So it's an illustration of that. But there were deaths in Texas last year. I mean, so this is not new that there are deaths in the United States. And it's a tragic situation. And there is a solution. Get the needle.
Get the vaccine done. But unfortunately, again, the Trump administration are generating a lot of fear and confusion. But it is safe. It is not linked to autism. There have been multiple studies showing that is not the case.
WTF. So let's go back to this conversation we had at the beginning of the show, Priya, which is about training and whether you're going to go on and get qualified. And this story is actually a really important story for consumers, non-medical people to know about, because you kind of just assume you become a doctor, you graduate, you then go on through the system. You know, it's tough. You train to become a general practitioner or a non-GP specialist like a surgeon and so on. And you just go through. And yeah, you might fall by the wayside, not pass your exams. People can understand that. And then you become the specialist. What people don't realize is that you could be in hospital for surgery and there are two junior doctors, two registrars looking after you. One of them could be on a training scheme heading for becoming a consultant surgeon, assuming they pass their exams. And the other is in a position that will never lead there, although they hope they're going to get there, because that position is not accredited by the College of Surgeons for training. So they're doing the same work as the other registrar.
The same hours, the same surgeries, yes. And you've just mentioned registrars there, both unaccredited and accredited. And once you're fully qualified, you're out the other end, you've passed all your exams, you get a certificate from the Royal Australian College of Surgeons, that's when you become a consultant within the public system. So you take on all the responsibilities and you have the team below you, the registrars sit within the team and you're at the head of it.
But these unaccredited registrars are sitting there hoping to get on the training scheme. They're on this pathway that actually can lead to nowhere, a dead end. And it's the people leading to that dead end that this story is about, from reporter Rachel Bongiorno.
Unaccredited registrars are fully qualified doctors doing registrar level work in hospitals. So they're at the coalface and they're providing that much needed care for the Australian population. I'm Dr. Sanjay Hittage and I'm the chair of the AMA Council of Doctors in Training.
Sanjay is one of the lucky ones. He recently completed his training, but he knows that these doctors stuck in limbo are treated very differently, despite doing the same work as accredited registrars like he was for the past few years.
The problem is that because of the lack of protections, they're staffing the nights, they're staffing the weekends, they're staffing the after-hours care in much greater proportion to those trainees that are on specialty training programs, but they don't have a clear pathway forward in their training. That means that they're prone to higher rates of burnout. That then affects their care that they can offer the public. And when that comes to patients, that can lead to problems with patient safety.
Another concern is sunk costs. It's expensive to go through medical school. The Australian taxpayer foots hundreds of thousands of dollars for each doctor. A med student could pay up to that themselves in fees, not to mention the thousands of dollars in postgraduate exams. That's a lot to give up, but Sanjay says the pressures of the growing bottleneck are pushing doctors out.
So in the medical training survey that's done annually as part of doctors' registration, one of the most pertinent questions was, are you considering leaving medicine in the next 12 months? And the 2025 results, national data for that was up nearly 10% are considering leaving, but for this cohort, it's up to 14%. And that's in the next 12 months. So that's a huge issue, considering we've already got issues retaining a high-quality medical workforce to make sure that we meet Australia's healthcare needs. But if these doctors don't have a clear career pathway and they're burning out, it means that we're not even retaining a medical workforce that we need.
The summary would be it was 4 months of hell.
The 31-year-old revealed the horror that made her walk away from her career dreams in a blog called The Ugly Side of Becoming a Surgeon.
It's been a hard lesson, but the lesson I've learned is that you have to put your health first.
That's Dr. Yumika Kudota speaking to ABC's 7:30 report in 2019. She'd just left her position as an unaccredited registrar due to severe burnout and a toxic workplace culture. Yumiko detailed her untenable workload in a blog post. She said her roster cycle involved 180 continuous hours on call in a fortnight, followed by one night off and then another 80 hours on call. Her body was pushed to the brink. When she finally quit, she said she was barely able to speak or move. She crashed her car on the way home before being treated in hospital with insomnia for over a month. But Sanjay says even 7 years on, things aren't getting better.
I think that Yumiko was extremely brave to put that spotlight on the space, and it led to a lot of discussion, including a New South Wales working group that was put together to actually look at possible solutions to tackle this problem. But things are not acted on because a lot of the time these solutions require money. It requires you to employ people to properly supervise these doctors. And I think because we've got a system that's, the demand is just exponentially growing, these problems just get compounded. So I would say it has not improved. And if anything, it's getting worse.
Dr. Helen Schultz is a consultant psychiatrist who treated doctors and med students for a number of years. She says the grueling competitive environment for unaccredited registrars in some specialties is so extreme that when some doctors finally get onto an accredited training program, they're so burnt out that they either leave medicine or they continue on but suffer in silence.
Unfortunately, a lot of them just soldiered on. They didn't want to tell anybody they were struggling. They felt a little bit like survivor guilt, I suppose. They had to be seen to be very grateful that they had one of these accredited positions. I had a few that I had to support and manage because, unfortunately, sometimes that struggle can actually lead to profound despair, hopelessness, and manifest as a clinical syndrome like a major depressive disorder. And we know that when things get that bad, there is risk, and there's risk of suicide. There's risk of misadventure. There's risk of self-medicating with substances.
I did think I was a less valuable member of the team at times.
Sarah, not her real name, is an accredited surgical registrar now and feels supported, but she spent 5 years as an unaccredited registrar. During that time, she didn't have access to educational training. She says it didn't just hold her back professionally, it also impacted morale.
Senior surgeons wouldn't want to train me. I didn't deserve to attend this teaching. I wasn't worthy to be there. Sometimes you are the most valuable member of the team. I remember taking 1 or 2 weeks of leave and things going crazy and then people being like, thank God you're back. And that was really heartwarming to say, oh, wow, you did recognise that I work hard.
This feeling of being undervalued along with the long hours meant the prospect of burnout was very real.
Very early on in my unaccredited registrar time, I had quite an unfair roster where I was working a lot more overtime than my accredited counterparts. And I was really scared. Often we're on call from Friday afternoon to Monday morning, which is very normal. But in this job, I was getting back to back to back phone calls and I just felt like I couldn't have a break. And it gets worse when other people are on leave as well. And then I found myself really fatigued, really tired, really stressed. And you know, I knew that I was good enough and I knew that other people have done similar jobs and you don't hear them complaining and thinking, is asking for help a sign of weakness? Am I not cut out for this? And I actually escalated to my senior registrar, which surprisingly, it was not helpful. They said, keep going. It's going to be good for you in the long term. You know, seeing all these consults, you're going to get a lot of experience. I knew that escalating could affect my references. But after a while, I thought it's not worth it. So I actually spoke up to my head of department. There wasn't an assigned supervisor for the unaccredited trainee about this unfair roster. And to my surprise, the head of department was really helpful and made significant changes. But I've seen other unaccredited trainees get exploited because it can be very uncomfortable to speak out and advocate for yourself when other people sort of control your fate.
The growing bottleneck of unaccredited registrars means more competition for accredited training positions at specialty colleges. Applicants are ranked based on points from their CVs, interviews and references, and that's created a culture of trying to one-up your colleagues by adding multiple masters, PhDs, research publications and conference papers to your application. All of that on top of your day and night job. But Sanjay says it's the references from their supervisors that really opens them up to exploitation.
Medicine is a very hierarchical field, meaning that the person that is directly supervising you is usually the one that you then rely on to get your next job. So if an unaccredited registrar has been exploited by their supervisor, they rely on that person to get a good reference to progress with their career. And if they complain about that person, well, that could mean that their career is over.
According to Dr. Helen Schultz, what adds to the mental distress of unaccredited registrars is that many internalise the issue rather than seeing the barriers to getting onto an accredited training program as structural.
They will say, it's my fault, I wasn't good enough, I missed out on that spot at that hospital because I didn't interview well, I didn't get the right references, I haven't been doing the right research with the right collaborators to make sure I get published. And so they would come to me either because they were burnt out and they really just wanted to get out of medicine and had developed this real tunnel vision that there's nothing else for me to do. They don't see themselves as the highly skilled and trained experts that they actually are in medicine and health. They see their only future as being something that they locked into years ago, perhaps even when they were a final year medical student.
It's now like medical school is being shoehorned into becoming a part of this rat race, whereas that's not the intention of university education at all. I'm Senra Mudanayake. I'm the president of the Australian Medical Students Association. I'm 1 year away from graduating at Monash Medicine.
Senra says the looming bottleneck of unaccredited registrars is terrifying for medical students. That's why this year the Australian Medical Students Association, or AMSA, has made it a major focus of their advocacy. Even as a third-year medical student, Senra felt like he was behind his peers who, because of family connections in medicine, knew what was coming.
So the first time I found out would have been on my first clinical year when I was in the hospital system and I saw these unaccredited registrars who were really stressed, really burnt out, and I frankly felt like I had been led astray.
His peers who were better connected knew they needed to join specialty uni groups or start research on top of their uni work early on.
Medical students are beginning to feel like their university education is less about protected learning time and less about understanding medicine as a concept to make them better doctors. And they're starting to feel the pressure that they need to be doing more so that they can actually become competitive for these roles even 5-10 years down the track.
Senaru says this can mean you start restricting yourself away from the more competitive specialties, like surgery.
This definitely shapes a lot of your impressions of what your career will look like, and it shapes fundamentally what you think is available to you.
And according to AMSA's research, it's this self-selection that can increase inequality in medicine. Not all students can afford to do the extracurriculars to compete. They need to work to support themselves and may have family caring responsibilities as well.
We realised very early on that this was affecting students from low socioeconomic backgrounds much, much more than their peers. And we understand that it's important that, you know, we increase the number of medical students looking to go into GP, we increase the number of medical students looking to do rural generalism. But it's still critical that the future cohorts of specialist doctors are representative of the patients that they treat. And these doctors, if they come from these disadvantaged backgrounds, are twice as likely to actually serve those disadvantaged areas.
But according to Dr. Sanjay Hettige, the chair of the AMA Council of Doctors in Training, addressing the growing bottleneck of unaccredited registrars and doctor shortages doesn't just come down to money. It's about better coordination between all the major players, including government, hospitals and specialty colleges.
We're calling for an independent health workforce planning agency to be re-established to make sure that this pipeline is taken care of from the beginning of med school to the end of specialty training. We clearly need more specialist positions because the Australian community are calling out for specialists in a number of areas, especially in rural remote regions. This is shown in this wait times for specialty clinics and surgical wait lists. So colleges need to come to the table and government needs to come to the table to fund more training positions that align with community need. We need more public hospital consultant jobs so that those people that then do that specialty training can then work in public hospitals. It is extremely hard to get public hospital jobs, even though there is a desperate need for more public hospital consultants to cover these public clinics and surgical wait lists. And we also need stronger protections for unaccredited registrars. So that means that they need to be treated like an accredited registrar. They need to have supervision, they need to have access to career planning, they need to have professional development, and they need to have safe working conditions.
Dr. Sanjay Hettige, Chair of the AMA Council of Doctors in Training, finishing that report by Rachel Bongiorno.
Now, really, the only college which is relevant to is the College of Surgeons, the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. The other colleges, like physicians and so on, do not have this gap between accredited and unaccredited positions. So we really need a response from the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. So just before we came on air, Priya and I spoke to the current president of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons, Dr. Philip Moreau, who's based in New Zealand.
Well, I don't think that's something that the college has got complete control of. We are a training entity for specialist surgery, and we have 9 different training programs across both countries. And that is a accredited program through the AMC. The problem of unaccredited registrars is clearly challenging, and we have to acknowledge the experience of these doctors.
So just before you go on, Philip, you say it's not really the purview of the college, but you're really the only college where it happens. If you're in the College of Physicians and you're doing a physician's training and you're a registrar in general medicine or a registrar in paediatrics, you're there to train and you can do the exam. You don't have one registrar working next to another, and they're both in the training scheme. Why is surgeons different?
Well, the structure of the training program is such that we can only train in the places that are provided by the jurisdictions and the states. We're not completely in control of that model. The training process occurs over a long period of time, and you're correct, we are involved with selection, we're involved with standards, we're involved with examination. But we can only place people in training positions when the jurisdictions actually fund those positions. And so that's not something that the college can completely control. But we're very aware of this as an issue, and that's why we're actively working to address this.
I'm still not really understanding it. Maybe I'm just being thick about this. But you're saying the states fund it. But the states also fund, you know, the other registrars in surgery, whether it's orthopedics, yeah, general surgery, what have you. So you've got 2 registrars working together, both funded by the state, yet the college only recognises one of those positions, hypothetically, but or proportion of them. So is it right to say that it's the state's problem rather than the college's problem?
We see it as a joint concern, obviously, and we're actively addressing that. But the doctors that are in training need to have adequate supervision, both clinical and educational. They need to have time for teaching, for study, for exams. They need administrative oversight. They need guidance and mentoring. And without all of the processes and parts of a training program, it's not something where at the moment there is the capacity. We would love to have more training positions available to take on more trainees. That's something which is very important to us and why we've recently launched our surgical pathway strategy, which is exactly regarding this.
So I had a look at that document, Philip, and I saw in there that there's a mention about diversified pathways, including routes that may not lead to a fellowship from the Royal Australian College of Surgeons. So it talks about broadening surgical capability. Is this a suggestion that someone might be able to be an unaccredited registrar and attain their full qualification for surgery without necessarily going through this RACS pathway?
So it wouldn't be a full qualification. And to be fair, this hasn't been fully established. This is a strategic plan and now it's about enacting it. But we're actively exploring ways in which we can address the skills and abilities of those doctors in unaccredited positions and, with appropriate supervision and credentialing, provide the jurisdictions and services within health departments a guide, or at least a structured assessment process that allows these doctors to work in an area where the community needs. It's not about reducing the standard of the fellowship. The standard of the fellowship is the standard, but it's about recognising the experiences of the unaccredited doctors. And we know that they provide an extremely important service capacity, but that's not necessarily the same as a training capacity. We would love to have more trainees. Don't misunderstand me.
So, again, just picking up on Priya's question about your strategy there. So you've got somebody going on in an unaccredited position. Most of them are not doing it because they love being in an unaccredited position. Most of them are doing it because they want a fellowship.
Yeah.
They want a fellowship of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. And they're hoping this is the pathway to that. And I suppose what your strategy is saying is, well, we'll make them slightly better surgeons because we'll give them a bit of training, but they might never become an accredited surgeon with the fellowship, able to practice independently and so on. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of cementing this process, aren't you?
No, well, I think there's other issues at play here. And there's no doubt that there are a large number of doctors being trained in Australia. And these doctors are, many of them are wanting to be surgeons. And, you know, it's a great career and I encourage them in that. But the number of training positions which are funded by our states and health services are insufficient to provide them with sufficient training slots. And the college is therefore hamstrung in its ability to train them. We would love to have more people in training positions. That's something that's very important to us.
So is it a lack of consultant surgeons, let's say vascular, plastic, general surgeons who can actually supervise these registrars? Is it that there's not physically enough space for them? What exactly is the issue? Is it a funding issue that the states might not fund another accredited training spot?
Correct. So the Commonwealth and the states and territories are responsible for funding the accredited training positions. It's not to say that there's not a dual responsibility. But we can only train people if there are funded positions available for registrars.
So let's imagine there are enough funded positions. I'm still missing something here, because I think Priya's question is really, are there enough consultants? So, which is really my question. There is a problem with surgeons in the public system in Australia. I don't know about New Zealand, but certainly in Australia. A lot of them are doing private work, and I certainly know, for example, in general orthopaedics, it's a bit of a challenge to get orthopaedic surgeons enough to cover the needs of orthopaedic surgery. And there's a variety of reasons. It's not necessarily people aren't willing. Is it simply that there's not enough surgeons spending enough time in the public system?
Yeah, look, I think that's part of it. I think there needs to be people who are working in the public sector, but it is still possible to train, and we're exploring this, the possibility of training in the private sector. But within whatever sector, there needs to be people who are appropriately trained to train, that have the time and capacity within their usual working structure to provide the intense both clinical and educational supervision, the mentorship and the guidance for surgical trainees. So that is part of the challenge.
So the areas where people, the community needs them, are often regional and remote communities. What is the college actively doing to service those communities and to make sure there's more equity in terms of access to surgical consultants?
There are a number of different initiatives which the college is taking, and that starts with a rural strategic plan which we've had for some time, for a number of years. We've looked at how we support services to be maintained in those areas. We look at different models for outreach into those areas. But it's also not just a training issue, it's also a service issue, that there needs to be commitment from the health services to actually work with the college and, you know, other specialties as well, to provide those services.
Dr. Philip Moreau is president of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. Have you had gout, Norman? Normally you love to share
Very personal question. No, I haven't.
You've never had gout?
I've never had gout.
You should touch wood.
Should I touch wood or touch my big toe?
Your big toe podagra. We all learn about that in med school.
We do.
Gout affecting your first big toe, for everybody listening. But gout is a very common condition. It's when you get these monosodium urate crystals that can accumulate within the joints. They get red, hot, very painful, swollen. And a lot of people go, well, it's a joint disorder. But that's not the case. It's actually much more systemic. And if you get gout, you're at high risk of heart disease. But the question is, how many gout flares Do you need to have in a year to put you at really high risk of a cardiovascular event? Well, there's a study that's looked at that. And I spoke to an author of the study, Dr. Charles Tong, who is a clinical nephrologist at Jiayi Christian Hospital in Taiwan.
So I think it's been known in studies for about the past 1 to 2 decades that people have looked at cardiovascular events. We commonly just refer to as heart disease. And some people have looked back to see whether if you had a gout attack in previously, then you're more likely to have a heart attack. So that's been known for a while. What we did in the study was to look at the number of gout attacks within a period of time. So we started from 2017. We used international database to look at patients. So we identified 44,000 patients with gout attacks, and we divided it into three groups, one with low gout attacks, moderate and high, and we defined it as low as having less than 3 gout attacks, moderate as 4 to 6 gout attacks, highest with more than 7 gout attacks within a period of 1 year. And after that 1 year, we followed up the patients for a 7-year period, and we looked at the likelihood of them having heart disease.
Yeah, so what did you find?
So we found, regardless of the three groups, they all had a, we called it major adverse cardio event. So it was heart disease related events, but it was the highest in the high group, especially when we compared it to the low group, which was less than 3 attacks. High group was more than 7 attacks.
So to be clear, Charles, it didn't matter whether you were one of these people having less than 3 attacks or more than 7, everyone with these gout flares had a higher risk of heart disease.
Well, what we looked at was within that 7-year period, whether they had heart events. So these were patients who didn't previously have heart disease. So I think previous studies told us that if you had a gout attack, you're more likely to have a heart disease. But we found that within all three groups, there was a proportion of patients with heart disease. But with more gout attacks, you have a higher likelihood of having heart disease.
So this is an observational study, so we can't really say that there's that direct link between gout flares and heart disease. But what is the proposed mechanism? Why is it that people who have gout flares, why do they get more heart disease?
So gout, for most people, it's just something, it's a nuisance, it's pain in the joint, but it also, it causes a systemic inflammation. There's a specific enzyme, it's called NARP3 inflammasome. So what it does is it increases the inflammation. We call it systemic inflammation, and it also causes oxidative stress. So this systemic inflammation not just affects your joints, but also your blood vessels. So it causes the likelihood of the blood vessels within your heart. It's more likely to, it's pro-inflammatory, also pro-atherosclerosis, which is calcification of the heart disease. So that's a proposed mechanism, yeah.
So it's not just in the joints, it really is this systemic inflammation kind of widespread. That's why people are at higher risk.
Yes. I think people have also been looking at whether we can reduce this inflammation and whether that can reduce the heart disease. But that obviously that's beyond the scope of our study.
So who's most at risk when it comes to heart disease and gout? What's the number here that if people are listening and they go, oh, that's me, I've had more than that many attacks, what's the number?
So we looked at the three groups, so the high frequency group, which was more than 7 gout attacks within 1 year. Well, that's obviously a very high number. What we found was that you were 27% more likely to have heart disease than those people with less than 3 attacks within a period of 1 year.
So this really helps to risk stratify people, doesn't it, in terms of heart disease? So if someone's got lots of gout flares, you go, they're at high risk of heart disease. How can this be used in clinical practice? What should be happening for patients with frequent gout flares? What should best practice look like?
So there are guidelines of when to intervene with number of gout attacks. So as a clinician, if you only have 1 gout attack a year, I would probably mostly just do dietary education. If you have frequent flares, which in our study was more than 7, but clinically probably more than 3 flares a year, we would treat these patients. And on top of dietary recommendations, how to reduce the high purine food, we would also give medications to lower your uric acid. And there are specific medications that we can use to lower uric acid.
And does the medication for uric acid lowering, Charles, does that actually, if you treat it, does that actually reduce the risk of heart disease?
It reduces number of gout attacks, so it's not because we did an observational study. currently, I think there's not direct evidence that by reducing uric acid levels, you can definitely reduce heart disease.
Okay, so you're really lowering the uric acid predominantly to stop someone having lots of gout flares so they're more comfortable. But presumably these people also need blood pressure checks and their cholesterol and all the heart disease stuff, those risk factors well managed.
Yeah, yes, definitely. So heart disease, there's a lot of traditionally we think of blood pressure, controlling blood pressure, treating diabetes, treating dyslipidemia. So it's called metabolic syndrome. But I think uric acid, having higher uric acid levels, having gout attacks, that's an additional risk factor that we want to control.
Dr. Kwai Ting Tong, who is a clinical nephrologist at Jia Yi Christian Hospital in Taiwan. So there you go. If you have gout, I think that's very relevant. And
keep it under control.
Yes, and go and get your heart disease risk assessment done. Go and see your friendly GP. They want to see you and do your blood pressure.
Well, at least Priya wants to see you, but she's got her books are full. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. What's in the mailbag?
So whilst you were away and sunning yourself and gallivanting...
When am I ever going to get, you know, get a leave pass?
But I was here slaving away and I did a story on prostate cancer screening and the updated guidelines that have come out. I think you would have quite enjoyed it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Martin has written in and says, I am now 63 and had my PSA rise to 12 and I had a biopsy.
So we just explained PSAs run around, you know, 2 or under, and when it starts getting over 2.5, people start to get anxious. There's a whole debate around this, but his went up to 12, which...
is high. Declan Murphy, who actually we had on the show last week, did say over 3. He starts to get worried, which is the number in the new guidelines.
You do know that the first research in this area, which was in California, if I remember rightly, triggered that the PSA that should be worried about was 25. That's how things have changed in this area.
Wow.
The trigger for a biopsy should be 25. But anyway, it's come down, such as, you know, it's come down.
Anyway, Martin continues. Sorry, we've had a small tangent there. In my opinion, Martin writes, the biopsy was premature as there was nothing on the MRI scan. The specialist recently told me I have no prostate cancer. As to the BRCA gene, not my doctor or specialist has ever mentioned a test for the BRCA gene, and how many men without a prostate issue would even know if they have this gene? That is usually, there's a strong family history. I, as the GP, am aware, and I send you to a familial cancer clinic, which is very well resourced with genetic counsellors, and you undergo testing. But it's not for everybody. It's not a run-of-the-mill test.
It's probably just worth saying at this point about genetic testing is that it's really important to know what goes on in your family and what has gone on in your family in the past. So, and not everybody knows that, but it's just, and it's important to know from a fairly early age. So have people been diagnosed with cancer under the age of 60? Is there a pattern of cancers? So, for example, it may not be the same cancer.
Yeah.
You might have had, there might be a first degree or second degree relative who's had breast cancer, and then a first degree relative who's had prostate cancer. But there's a lot of cancer around at an early age. That's a sort of signal that's worth talking to your doctor about. And then you might get tested for the genes after you've had some counselling. But these genes are so rare that we just couldn't afford as a country to screen everybody for them.
Stephen has written in from Tasmania, also related to the prostate cancer story, where basically digital rectal exams are out the window. They're not required anymore. It's just the blood test if you opt to go into the screening program. And Stephen writes, a digital rectal examination saved my life. 12 years ago, I had a low PSA, but a digital rectal examination revealed some abnormal roughness. A biopsy detected a low to medium risk of cancer, but within 12 months, the cancer had escaped the prostate capsule with the PSA still low. Surgery has me in remission and my PSA is now undetectable.
That's great news.
Mm.
But it just shows how crude a test PSA can be. You can have cancer with a low PSA. And as Martin wrote earlier, he had a high PSA, but didn't have cancer. So you've got to do further things. And that's the importance of the MRI scan, mm-hmm. is that the MRI scan can tell you whether there is something there to be worried about. And we've got somebody writing in from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yes. Now, were you here? No, you, again, you were away for the story. Sorry. Bell and
you do
I.
All the best stories
it was
on
actually
the way.
Bell
I
and I.
I should stay away more often. I should fly in
you
the
shouldn't.
Beach more often.
I actually did miss you, Norman. Yeah. And I actually said that to you off air. So it's on the record and off the record now. But okay. Body mass index, we did a story on that because there was a study that suggested that we should be doing more waist circumference and waist hip ratio because BMI is unreliable and it kind of helps to risk stratify people further. But Marianne has written in saying, do any of the studies of waist circumference take the well-known waist circumference increase that goes with menopause into account? I'm 75 and weigh the same now as I did 25 years ago, but I can't wear the same pants or skirts because the waistband won't close. The belly is just there. I do resistance training 3 to 4 times per week to try to maintain muscle mass. I think my waist circumference is just at the upper limit of the normal range. How does this affect my risk? What's recommended for decreasing visceral fat?
Really good question. And
I could go for days on this.
And as with a lot of things in medicine, it hasn't been particularly well researched in women. It's generalized to everybody that if you develop an increased waist circumference, the risk is considered equal between men and women. It might be you might be a little bit later on the risk scale with women, but it's not been properly researched.
And I would just also add that if you're on the upper end of normal, this is the kind of discussions I have with patients who go, what else can I do? If you're physically active, you're eating your rainbows, there's some things you can't combat, your genetic, other factors that are against your control. But also, I would say that you're nailing it. What I say to patients is you're already optimizing everything. Maybe this is what the cards that we are dealt with. You're right. There's a lack of research in the hormonal influences on the waist circumference and risk stratification. But also diet culture has led us to believe, Norman, that our waist should be smaller than what they are. Say I could go on for days.
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I was talking to, actually, I won't say who it was, but it's a well-known Australian medical
author.
Person.
Well-known. Is it me?
No, and it's not me. Who said to me, well, why is my tummy, he was saying, I'm going to write in a question to the health report or what's that rash, saying, why is my tummy large, kind of the dad shape? And I've been trying to do exactly the same question. And I think, the other thing to weigh it against is what are your bloods telling you?
Yes.
Is your blood sugar under good control? Is your cholesterol under
what's
at
your blood
the right
pressure?
Level? And all those things, if they're in good shape, relax a bit.
And you can maintain health in a larger body, whatever body size you are. Let's just, all the weight stigma and diet culture stuff. I reckon, Marianne from Charlottesville, Virginia, you're nailing it. That would be my takeaway in the consulting room.
And what I'd say to men is just wear a corset if it troubles you.
Is that what you're doing?
No.
We do love hearing from you, so please write to us. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And I'll just release the corset. Yeah, <another one. laughs> don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash? And this week we ask whether rest is important when you go to the gym. Mm. Should you have a day off?
That's interesting. I'm not, I think the more activity, the better. But anyway, let's listen and find out.
I just had a week off, unless you keep on telling me.
Yeah, 2 weeks actually. But I'll see you next week because you'll be here, right?
Yeah, and I'm just off to the gym now.
Oh, good.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.